From WIPR, I'm Sheila Cast. We're on the record. Johns Hopkins amassed millions by trying almost anything that promised to make money, investing in liquor, real estate, coal mining, fertilizer, and more. He never married, and it was only after he'd retired from most of those businesses that the public saw what he intended to do with his fortune: create a university, including a medical school, and a hospital. The impetus may have occurred 30 years earlier. Author Antero Pietola spells it out.
When he was 37 years old, he had a brush with death when there was a cholera epidemic in Baltimore. He nearly died, and I think that his interest in medicine came from that incident.
Beyond the man himself, how have his institutions shaped Baltimore? Pietola guides us through his book, The Ghosts of Johns Hopkins, on the record after the news.
You're listening to On the Record, the podcast, a service of your public radio, 88.1 WYPR. Find more podcasts online at wypr.org. And tell us what you think. Send an email to ontherecord@wypr.org.
Good morning, I'm Sheila Cast. We're on the record. Like many readers in Baltimore, I know the name of former Baltimore Sun reporter Antero Pietola mostly for the remarkable book he published in 2010, Not in My Neighborhood, How Bigotry Shaped a Great American City, a meticulously researched picture of residential segregation and discrimination toward blacks and Jews. When I heard that Pietola's latest book is called The Ghosts of Johns Hopkins, The Life and Legacy That Shaped an American City, I was a bit surprised. It sounded like a biography of the man whose fortune created a renowned university and a world-famous hospital, not what I expected. Then I started reading and realized you could call it a biography on steroids. So I was glad for the opportunity last November to ask Pietola directly, what are the ghosts of Johns Hopkins? There are a lot of big ideas in his book, but just as many intriguing details, and I started with something small. Why is there an S at the end of Johns Hopkins' first name?
The S comes from the family name of his great-grandmother. The first Johns Hopkins was his grandfather, Johns Hopkins. And so that was the family name of his great-grandmother was Johns.
But he wasn't called Johns as a kid.
He was called as the family members, they called him Johnsy.
Pretty affluent upbringing?
Very much so. They were farmers in today's Crofton in Anne Arundel County, and they had received several hundred acres from the King of England. And Johns Hopkins himself was a descendant of William the Conqueror.
So he wasn't as wealthy in his youth as he would come to be, but he was never poor. Where did he get his impulse to address the problems of the less fortunate?
Well, he really did not leave that many papers behind, and so we are doing lots of guesswork. And the best I can guess here is that when he was 37 years old, he had a brush with death when there was a cholera epidemic in Baltimore. He nearly died, and I think that his interest in medicine came from that incident. Now, his own schooling ended at the age of 12. It was a big family farm, and so all the kids had to work on the farm.
So he didn't have a lot of formal education.
He did not have lots of formal education, but as a result of the cholera epidemic, he had lots of sleeping problems. So when he could not sleep, he kept reading. It was his antidote to insomnia, and so he was very much interested in many things in his life, and particularly he thought that he was divinely assigned to make money.
So divinely assigned,
yes,
to make money. Tell,
yes,
us why we think that.
Well, this is what a profiler who did a profile of him concluded, and
Laura Holloway was her name.
Laura,
right?
Holloway,
and she,
yes,
was writing in the 19th century, not,
yes,
long after he died.
Yes.
So how did she know that he saw his divine mission to make money?
Well, Johns Hopkins left behind some comments that suggest that. For instance, he said that while he dearly loved his estate, Clifton, as in today's Clifton Park, that he was thinking of selling it because he hated anything that did not produce money. And Clifton was a wonderful place for him to play a farm boy. He had lots of flower beds there and orchards, but at the same time, it did not produce any money.
He was a Quaker?
He was a Quaker.
Is that part of where this impulse to help people came from?
It certainly did, but at the same time, he overcame his Quaker beliefs in making money early on in his career by selling liquor. So he was this upstart in Baltimore who was selling liquor. And the reason why he was selling liquor was that in those days, there was no national currency. And so people could not use cash that would be recognized by outside banks, which insisted on payment in silver. So what Johns Hopkins did was he started bartering with the farmers. And that was the time when any traffic that happened was pretty much done on Conestoga wagons. Well, you could not transport many commodities on Conestoga wagons. For instance, grain was impossible, but liquid grain was possible to transport.
And that so, is to say booze.
Right. And so he would take, he would accept homebrewed liquor, brand it and bottle it in Baltimore and sell it as Hopkins Best.
That was one of his early enterprises.
That was one of his early enterprises.
That's author Antero Pietola here on The Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about his book, The Ghosts of Johns Hopkins, The Life and Legacy That Shaped an American City. He's speaking at the Engineers Club on Sunday at 2 p.m. That cholera epidemic, you write about how the medical establishment essentially blamed the victims.
Yes.
Tell us more about that.
Cholera was seen as a punishment for ungodly living. And so it's interesting that in 1832, when Baltimore detects its first cholera cases, there is a demand by doctors in a meeting with the mayor that the mayor denied that cholera exists in Baltimore at all. And by a narrow margin, they voted that to some extent cholera did exist in Baltimore.
You quote a Harvard medical historian of the time, Charles Rosenberg, that, quote, the Irish and the Negroes, the most filthy, intemperate, and imprudent portion of the population, and hence the poorest of Americans, were, not surprisingly, the most frequent victims of cholera, close quote.
That is pretty much accurate, yes.
So that was kind of a pervasive attitude in
yes,
medicine at the time.
Yes, it was. And so... But it's kind of interesting that there's another connection to the cholera epidemic that then becomes apparent decades later. The first cholera hospital in Baltimore was a hospital in East Baltimore called Maryland Hospital. And it was located at the site of today's Johns Hopkins Hospital. And so Johns Hopkins then, a couple of years after the cholera epidemic, becomes a board member of the Maryland Hospital, which then moves to Catonsville as Spring Grove Mental Hospital. So Johns Hopkins' interest in medical matters, I think, goes back to his experience with cholera.
It was a few years before Hopkins died of pneumonia in 1873, you write, that the public got its first inkling of what he intended to do with his vast fortune.
Yes.
What was that inkling?
Well, he announced that he was going to create a university and a hospital, and he also wanted to create a medical school. And so all these were stipulations in his will. And so what was interesting about the hospital part was that he was very detailed about what he wanted the hospital to be. He wanted it to look like a great hospital, which he wanted it to be in medical terms as well. Whereas he said hardly anything about the university. What created quite a stir in Baltimore in 1870 was Johns Hopkins's determination to have the hospital take care of indigents regardless of age, gender, or color.
One of his instructions for the hospital was to build and operate an orphan asylum. Describe that.
He wanted to have an orphan asylum that was not on the hospital grounds and which ended up being located next to the Hopkins Homewood campus, today's Homewood campus. And so...
And this was to be an orphan asylum...
For so-called colored children, orphans, from the Civil War and other deserving kids. And so he was very serious about this. He returned to this edict in several of his codicils that were attached to his will, and he said that his orphan's asylum should be well-funded and could use up to one-fourth of the hospital budget. Of course, this then became a matter of contention for the trustees who, in relatively short order, got rid of the orphan's asylum altogether.
They just didn't do it.
They didn't do it.
One of the few times the word ghost appears in your book, Beyond the Cover, is when you write, in relation to that evaporation, Johns Hopkins, the man, became a ghost. Explain that.
Johns Hopkins was a man who guarded his privacy very tightly. He never married. He had been in love with his cousin, but that planned union was disapproved by her parents. So Johns Hopkins also protected his privacy by having powerful friends. It is amazing how little we have in terms of newspaper clippings from the Baltimore Sun, and one of the reasons was that the founder of the Sun, Aruna Abel, was not only a neighbor of Johns Hopkins, but also was a good friend who signed one of the codicils. So there wasn't much written about him. It is said that people were afraid of him, that he was so powerful that they did not want to say anything about him while he was alive, but there was nothing really said after he died either.
But here's a situation where he spells out quite clearly and publicly something he once done with his money, and the men whom he has appointed as trustees to implement that will just end up ignoring it.
But the men whom he had appointed may have been his friends, but in many ways they were likely very different from him. For instance, he was an abolitionist. He came from a slave-owning background, but he was an abolitionist in a city where on a daily basis he dealt with powerful rich men who were slave owners. And so I'm sure that I haven't really looked into it, but I'm sure that among his appointees to the Johns Hopkins board were some men who also had slaves.
We're revisiting our conversation from last November with Antero Pietola about his book, The Ghosts of Johns Hopkins, The Life and Legacy That Shaped an American City. He'll be speaking about it Sunday, March 24th, at 2 p.m. at the Engineers Club, 11 West Mount Vernon Place. The event is hosted by the Garrett Jacobs Mansion Endowment Fund and Baltimore Heritage. I'm Sheila Cast. We'll keep tracing those ghosts after a short break. Stay with us on The Record.
This is the On the Record podcast, a service of Your Public Radio, member-supported 88.1 WYPR. You can support this podcast and everything you hear from WYPR. Become a member. Come to WYPR.org and click the donate link.
Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. Journalist Antero Pietola's book, The Ghosts of Johns Hopkins, The Life and Legacy That Shaped an American City, is a deep dive into the sometimes surprising fallout of the bequest of a rich businessman to fund a university and hospital. When Pietola and I spoke last fall, I asked what he meant by the ghosts of Johns Hopkins.
What I mean is that in the long history of the Johns Hopkins institutions, there are many ghosts. Johns Hopkins, because of his scarcity of his written instructions for the university or the hospital, is a ghost whose intentions then trustees whom he had appointed felt free to interpret any which way they wanted to. But there were other ghosts as well. There were people who were involved in medical experiments. One of them that I talk about is Jesse Lazier, who was a Johns Hopkins man who became a member of a commission, army commission in Cuba, that consisted of Johns Hopkins men, the rest of the commission as well, and therefore underlined how Johns Hopkins in a very short period of time had become very respected and a powerful institution medically. So his intention was to conquer the yellow fever, and he did that by experimenting himself, and so he let a mosquito bite him, and the mosquito then gave him the yellow fever, and he died. But I mean, there are many ghosts. There are ghosts like President Bauman, who was the president during the 1940s, 1950s. He was an anti-Semite at a time when many of the other universities that had had anti-Semitic admission policies were getting rid of those. At that point, Bauman introduced quotas at Johns Hopkins.
You double down on the expert reporting of your earlier book, Not in My Neighborhood, to describe how redlining enforced segregation. But even before the federal government adopted redlining as official policy in the 1930s, you write about what you call the rotations of ethnic and racial groups in Baltimore. What was rotating?
Well, here is my take. American neighborhoods do not belong to any social class, race, or ethnicity, or religion. They change from one class of people to another one over the years according to economic and political circumstances. And so, in Not in My Neighborhood, I talked about ethnic rotations on the West Side. This is a book largely about ethnic rotations around the Hopkins Institution and downtown. And so I chronicle the rotations of neighborhoods from German to Irish to Jewish to Bohemian, and try to give an idea as to how this city existed in those years.
And also, you chronicle what happened to black residents.
Of course.
In those neighborhoods.
Of course.
You write at length about the redevelopment in both West and East Baltimore in the 1980s and since. And at one point, you described Hopkins' role as, quote, the land grab and wholesale raising of 800 properties in the 88-acre extension to the medical campus, close quote. That particular line is a harsh assessment. What's your overall assessment of Hopkins' effect on its neighbors?
Johns Hopkins has always had trouble with its neighbors, and the neighbors have had trouble with Johns Hopkins. For several decades, until the 1950s, its closest neighbors were Bohemians, Czechs. And Hopkins had very little contact with them, and Hopkins clearly also had very little contact with the black community that was creeping toward the Hopkins institutions. So the mistrust was on both sides. Black people called Hopkins the plantation, and so that impact really has been great over various time periods. It is great now around the Broadway campus as well as in Bayview in further East Baltimore. Now, there is lots of controversy about the redevelopment around the hospital area. And this is what the quotation referred to that you read. What I want to make clear in the book is that what we actually have in East Baltimore is regentrification because
regentrification
because the neighborhoods around Johns Hopkins were not always poor. And in my mind, the opposite of gentrification is further slumification. So unless the Hopkins neighborhood can be regentrified, they really don't have any future. And clearly, if they don't have any future, then the institution itself is in danger. I talk about in the book about the time after the Baltimore riots in 1968, when Johns Hopkins was examining its future options, going so far as talking about possibly relocating the hospital and medical school out of East Baltimore.
That's author Antero Pietla here on The Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about his book, The Ghosts of Johns Hopkins, The Life and Legacy That Shaped an American City. This is such an expansive book. You mentioned, for example, what you consider an ingrown bureaucracy dominating Baltimore's public school system. You talk about the city's failure to have a strong broadband for its citizens. And about the Hopkins brand, you write, quote, "In a branch office city of limited ambitions, Johns Hopkins was the exception, a global premium brand, a diversified $6.3 billion corporation," close quote. Now, as you write, when Hopkins started in the 19th century, there were lots of other hospitals, lots of other colleges in Baltimore. I don't think it was obvious that Hopkins would be the preeminent, or was it? What is it about Hopkins that has pushed it to excellence and leaving the city behind in some ways?
It was goal setting in that Hopkins was going to be a university, unique American university or German type, a graduate university. So when Johns Hopkins University, the humanities part first opens, there are hardly any undergraduate students. It is a graduate school. Now, similarly, the hospital was a research hospital, and that was quite unique in those days. So that was certainly one of the reasons for that. Hopkins is worldwide, as you pointed out. I went to the United Arab Emirates, and there are three hospitals in that part of the Middle East that are operated by Hopkins. Hopkins is present in Saudi Arabia, where 350,000 employees and dependents of the Aramco oil company are cared for in a program that is jointly operated by Hopkins.
You brought a lot of knowledge to this book. What surprised you in your research?
Well, let me tell you why I did this book. I wanted to do a book that would continue but would be independent of Not in My Neighborhood, that but would continue the thrust and explain to newcomers to Baltimore as well as old Baltimoreans how the city became what it is today, and also explain who certain people in our history were. For instance, my generation may take William Donald Schaefer for granted and many other people, but for today's Baltimoreans, William Donald Schaefer means less and less, and even to those who know the name, they may not remember what he did. And so part of the book catalogues the time period when he was the mayor of Baltimore for 16 years.
It's a fascinating book. Thank you.
Well, thank you.
Antero Pietla's book is called The Ghosts of Johns Hopkins, The Life and Legacy That Shaped an American City. He'll be speaking about it Sunday, March 24th at 2 p.m. at the Engineers Club, 11 West Mount Vernon Place in Baltimore. The event is hosted by the Garrett Jacobs Mansion Endowment Fund and Baltimore Heritage. We have a link to more information at the On the Record page at WIPR.org. I'm Sheila Cass. Glad you're with us on The Record. Come back tomorrow.
Thanks for for listening to this segment of On the Record with Sheila Cast. You can catch the show on the radio Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 10 a.m. on 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station. And you can support On the Record and all the other public radio programs that WYPR brings to you. Just click the donate link at the top of WYPR.org. And thanks.